Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You've clicked on the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Nice clicking. Today, we bring you an update from Patrick Martin, the journalist who did the analysis and showed that the Democrats are recruiting large numbers of former spies and military veterans to run for Congress this year, and 20 of them have cleared the primaries. We will name names. There will be spies in the House. This podcast is enabled by listeners like you who take out subscriptions. People like Jim Garrison, Pauline Nixon, the folks at Technical Support Cooperative, and Bill Janetta. I'd like to thank them for their support and ask you to join in. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the home, You land on the sign-up page, and in just a couple of minutes, you can sign up for a subscription that fits your budget. I appreciate your support, and I'm glad you're listening. Graham Nash croons us into the podcast today with Military Madness. As Patrick Martin returns to the podcast for an update on his very important research on the candidates who've been recruited by the Democratic establishment to run for contested seats in Congress this year. Patrick is the Detroit-based journalist who publishes at the World Socialist website, and he published a pamphlet called The CIA Democrats that came out toward the end of April based on the work that we discussed back in March. Patrick, thanks for being with me again today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've seen some progress on the march of spooks and military veterans into the halls of Congress through the primary process. And again, I want to credit you for the analysis that you brought forward that alerted me and many of my listeners to this trend. And we've seen corporate media reporting about the large numbers of women running in both parties, but predominantly Democrats. But I have not seen this kind of analysis in the corporate media so far. You follow this better than I do. Has anybody picked up on your work at a major outlet?
Well, no one has provided an overview connecting all these things. But there have been occasional reports to the effect that military candidates are among those being promoted by the Democratic Party leadership. And the most recent primaries in New Jersey and then Tuesday in Virginia, because there were so many military and intelligence candidates who won nominations, it was hard to avoid. In New Jersey, there were five open seats for which the Democrats are running, or five contested seats for which the Democrats have nominated candidates, and four of them were either ex-military or ex-intelligence.
And Mikey Sherrill tends to get the lion's share of the corporate media coverage.
Yeah, because she is in the New York metropolitan area. She is the only one of these candidates out of the dozens who has been specifically endorsed and written up by the New York Times, which tends to set the media agenda. She got her own endorsement by the Times in the primary, which is quite unusual. No explanation, actually. If you read the editorial, it's completely incomprehensible why they're supporting her over her opponent, who is politically indistinguishable from everything I could understand, and was a local elected official or a former elected official, and then a corporate executive who was African-American woman. So there wasn't any reason in terms of identity politics or issues to support her. The only distinction between the two was that she had a military background, and she had raised $2.5 million, which is five times as much as her opponent. And then after Tuesday's election, the first actual admitted CIA operative to be nominated by the Democratic Party in this cycle won the nomination in the 7th District of Virginia, and that's Abigail Spanberger. She will be the Democratic candidate against David Bratt, who you may remember as the ultra-right winger who upset Eric Cantor four years ago. He is a sort of semi-libertarian economist, but his main issue is immigrant bashing. He ran against Cantor specifically on the question of denouncing any effort to compromise on the question of admission of immigrants or legalization of immigrants, of undocumented immigrants. And so he can, in fact, claim to have been Trump before Trump was Trump.
And let me just quote, because you summed this up very accurately and vividly in an article posted on June 14th. The people of the 7th Congressional District will thus have a choice in the candidates of the major establishment parties between an ultra-rightist who specializes in anti-immigrant demagoguery and a former operative for the most reactionary and murderous organization on the planet, responsible for torture, widespread violations of democratic rights, and the deaths of millions of people.
Well, I did write that, and I stand by it. I don't always quote myself in my own interviews, but that was fine. Thank you.
No, you didn't quote yourself. I did it for you.
Yes.
You can maintain a pose of humility, Patrick.
I think that, as I told you in the first interview, I was first tipped off to this phenomenon by a small notice in a political blog on the Washington Post website, which noted that Abigail Spanberger and a woman named Alyssa Slotkin, who is up in my neck of the woods in Michigan, were seeking the Democratic nominations, that they had just become candidates. And it was unusual because both of them had been CIA agents and were public about the fact that they had been CIA agents. And this is unusual because not only is it exceptional for political candidates to acknowledge that in their background, it's also unusual for the agency to allow them to do so. Because if you were an undercover operative in a foreign assignment, you probably had a cover. You had a cover occupation. You worked for the State Department or for AID or for some NGO. You had some cover occupation. And if you then acknowledge that during that time you were working for the CIA, that is considered to be blowing the cover of whatever job that was or organization it was where you were slotted.
And Patrick, the recent confirmation of Bloody Gina Haspel as CIA director allowed her to choose what parts of her own history were shared secretly with senators and what parts were sanitized for public dissemination.
Right.
But we know very little about Gina Haspel's dark history, with the exception of the torture episodes, which are pretty damn dark. And to see candidates like Slotkin being able to selectively use their CIA CV, if you will, as a political campaign tool is a fascinating contrast.
Yeah, it's something that is a new quality in American politics. It used to be something that you would not only were you required to keep it under wraps for operational reasons by the CIA itself, it was something that you wanted to keep under wraps because it would not be a positive credential. The American people had been raised over many years having seen the activities of the CIA overseas with a considerable degree of disgust. I mean, my generation, we went through the Phoenix program, which was a program of mass assassination in Vietnam, supervised by the CIA. The spying on anti-war protesters within the United States and internationally, in which the CIA participated. The overthrow of social democratic and liberal and nationalistic regimes going as far back as Iran, Mossadegh.
Mm-hmm.
Through to the Allende in Chile in 1973. So the CIA was always identified with grossly anti-democratic practices, and therefore to have that as a credential for running as a candidate in what is supposed to be a democracy was not a very good thing. Now, because of the change in the political climate over the last 20 years, particularly since 9/11, the systematic propaganda effort to portray the intelligence agencies of the U.S. government as somehow benefactors. They're like the Mother Teresa's with guns. They're saving us from terrorism. Not the fact that most of the terrorist organizations in the world at some point or other have gotten funding, and certainly diplomatic assistance from the U.S. government.
Well, and even more recently, Patrick, just to add the political dimension to it, as Bush held two terms, Democrats were pretty solidly critical of the CIA and the lies that led to Bush's decision or his activation of the decision to invade Iraq. And the shift due to Trump and Russiagate and Obama's normalization of surveillance and drone strikes and all kinds of covert military action has produced a profound shift in the attitudes of the leaders of the Democratic Party. And I believe that they are very much adrift from the rank-and-file members of the Democratic Party. And it's, really typified by this recent DNC decision of the Bernie ban to require that any candidate for president has to be a card-carrying party member and pledge to stay a member if he or she is elected president. I can't think of anybody else that these punitive rules would apply to. And that application of misguided democratic purity, party purity, consigns the Democrats to being outside the White House for the foreseeable future, in my view.
Well, I think that the... in terms of the historical development, there is some transitions that are worth pointing out. The Obama administration was an extremely important one, and even during that administration, there were conflicts between the CIA officials, including those appointed by Obama, and Democrats in Congress. You had the famous episode of involving the CIA torture investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee, in which the CIA hacked into the computers of the Senate Intelligence Agency and conducted essentially illegal surveillance of Congress to try to get a look at what the Senate Intelligence Committee knew, which is pretty amazing in and of itself from the standpoint of democratic politics. Because the Senate Intelligence Committee is supposedly the arm of Congress for monitoring what the CIA does. It's supposed to know. And here you had the agency that is nominally subject to the Senate Intelligence Committee spying on the committee to make sure that the committee did not know and did not say what the CIA was doing behind closed doors around the world in these secret torture centers. And you had the point where Feinstein had to go on the floor of Congress and speak using her legislative privilege so that she could speak without danger of being arrested, and criticize Brennan for the CIA spying on the Senate. That was a pretty fantastic episode.
And the Obama White House closed ranks with Republicans to prevent the real publication of that report, and it's been almost fully suppressed. And this set the stage for a torture participant, Gina Haspel, to be nominated and confirmed as CIA director with critical votes from Democrats.
Right.
She would not have been confirmed if the Democrats that are afraid of being unseated this fall just voted present. You know, they could have.
I would caution you on one thing,
yeah.
And that is the following. I happen to agree with the comment that I think it was Tom Cotton made in the course of the debate on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He said that if Hillary Clinton had been elected and she had nominated Gina Haspel, she would have gotten a unanimous vote. And I think that's true. Clinton would have been, as the first woman president, quite happy to nominate Gina Haspel as the first female CIA director, regardless of her background.
I'd only quibble with the unanimous part. I think there are a handful of Democrats.
Maybe Wyden would have voted against. That's true. Or maybe Rand Paul.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Possibly. But he wasn't on the committee.
Right.
In any case, you get my drift.
I certainly do.
For the most part, Democratic Party criticism of the CIA depends upon whether there's a Democrat in the White House. And when there's a Democrat in the White House, things that the CIA did, which they find highly questionable, immediately become absolutely fine, rubber stamp them. And, of course, the same thing is true of the Republicans.
So, with that in mind, returning to the congressional primaries, in the June 14th post, you write, the results confirm the main political trends in the two corporate-controlled parties, with both parties moving further to the right. The Republicans are embracing candidates who echo the fascistic demagoguery of the Trump White House, particularly directed against immigrants. The Democratic Party continues to select candidates drawn to an extraordinary extent from the national security apparatus, ex-CIA, military intelligence, and combat commanders. And you note that there are now a total of 20 nominees, about one-third of those who survived the primaries and will face off against a Republican in most cases in the fall. California has a couple of cases where Democrats will face Democrats. You continue, a career in the military intelligence apparatus is by far the largest occupational category for such nominees, more than state and local government, the legal profession, or the corporate and business hierarchy. And Patrick, let's go back to the 2006 cycle, where the Democrats did win back control of the House, making Nancy Pelosi Speaker. And all of the recruiting that year had been done by Rahm Emanuel, who is now the mayor of Chicago. And he recruited a bunch of self-funding, blue dog-type Democrats. And the control that Pelosi had was largely undermined by the fractures in her caucus. And so as the Democrats hope for a blue wave, I consider it a remote possibility, to regain control of the House this fall, they appear to be arming up with these soldiers and spies, and this has to be part of a concerted strategy. And so what have you been able to ferret out about who has been recruiting these individuals and, you know, working the red-to-blue strategy to give them unfair advantages in over progressives in particular in the primaries?
Well, I think you have to understand, first of all, what the terrain or the battlefield actually is. There are, of course, 435 seats in the House in the House of Representatives. Of those, perhaps 350 are unshakably either Democratic or Republican under the present electoral system and the present boundaries. No Republican is ever going to be elected to Congress from San Francisco. And no Democrat is ever going to get elected to Congress from rural Alabama. But the subset that we're concerned about is the 80 or 90 seats that are for the most part, held by Republicans, but which could swing in the case of an election.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Democratic Party is about as low as it can get in terms of, there are only about six, I think, seats that are considered to be up for grabs that are currently held by Democrats. The vast majority of the so-called competitive or swing seats are held by Republicans. And the question that we're discussing is, who is being selected to be the nominees of the Democratic Party in those 75, 80, or 90 seats? So far, about 60 of those nominees have been selected. And 20 of them, and I have a list, are from this category of former military. Three more on Tuesday, that brought the total to 20. There's also a number of military people who are running in districts which are not considered competitive, where they're going to be the Democratic candidates, and that gives them a certain standing, but they are not going to win unless there's a complete collapse by the Republicans, which is probably unlikely at this point. So you've had this selection, and there's still now going to be about 30 or so more chosen. 2 weeks from now in New York is a major election, and then there are no primaries in July, and then the rest of them will be completed in August. So it looks like at this point, since they've already got 20, that it's going to be about 30 or so, 30 or 35 from this category of people. And if the Democrats, these are going to be Democratic candidates. If the Democrats won even close to that many of the swing seats, they would then become the majority party in the House of Representatives. They need to win 23 new seats. So we're already talking about where the military intelligence category is approaching the total number of seats that they need to win in order to take control, right? Because it's 20, and they would need 23. Now, whether these candidates all win is another question. That depends upon the political landscape, and I don't think that's completely... It's manipulated by the media, but it's not completely controlled.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there can be all sorts of unexpected events. You know, this week you have peace breaking out in North Korea, which will last maybe 24 hours as a media sensation. By October, you could have war breaking out, you know, and it could be war in different countries. You know, one doesn't know. Terrorist events, financial shocks, such as the collapse of a major corporation or bank. So we can't predict exactly what the outcome is going to be. But we do know one thing, and that is if there is a swing to the Democratic Party to the extent that they win control of Congress, this category is going to have decisive control. Now, I don't believe that this is an operation being done to the Democratic Party by some outside force.
No, I don't either.
It's not a takeover. if you want, it's a friendly takeover.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's a takeover where the management of the Democratic Party, particularly in the House of Representatives, is avidly seeking out such candidates. And the amounts of money that these candidates are able to raise indicates that the traditional big financial backers of the Democratic Party, the George Soroses of this world and others, are kicking in money to these candidates at the direction of the leadership of the Democratic Party. I mean, how does somebody who is a retired fighter pilot, whose husband has a regular middle management job, raise $2.5 million to run for Congress? You can't do that. You know, you can't do that if you are a state senator. All right, Amy McGrath raised $2.5 million in Kentucky. The state senator from Lexington, who was running in the race, was only able to raise $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor of Lexington, Jim Gray, who has a national name because he ran for Senate against Rand Paul whatever it was, 2012, and is, I believe, the whatever distinction. He is one of the handful of openly gay major city mayors in the United States. And he's also independently wealthy. His family runs a construction company in central Kentucky. So he's a millionaire. He was able to raise a little over $1 million. He's outraised 2-to-1 by somebody who most recently worked for the U.S. government on a salary. So clearly there was money that went into her campaign, and that money was directed, at least in part, by the leadership of the Democratic Party. Now, they in that race, they took a somewhat hands-off approach because Gray had a lot of connections. But in some of the other races, they have actually designated the military intelligence candidate under their Red to Blue program, which is the program that the congressional leadership, Pelosi, Jim Clyburn, Steny Hoyer, and I guess it must be Joe Crowley, they pick who's in that program.
Right.
And that is their top 25 or 30 people. Many of these candidates, and I can tell you if you want to know, but many of these candidates, Chrissy Houlihan in Pennsylvania is red to green. Red to blue. Not red to green. Yes, Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan is red to blue.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you another one. Dan McCready in North Carolina is red to blue. This is the guy who found Jesus in the waters of the Euphrates River. Nancy Soderbergh in Florida, former State Department high-ranking official, is red to blue. And Lauren Bayer, who is a State Department legal advisor to Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, is red to blue in Florida. So this is not an invasion of the Democratic Party by an outside force.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Democratic Party leadership. In the same way that Rahm Emanuel sought out self-funders and more conservative business types in 2006, there's still some of that. They have a number of self-funders in California, particularly.
Right.
Gil Cisneros was designated. Lisa Brown in Washington State was designated. She's the chancellor of Washington State University, and so on. I mean, they have some people who they've brought in who aren't from military backgrounds.
Well,
but from high-level corporate or business environments if they're not from the military.
So and Patrick, not, as
these
I've...
Are not the, these are not the insurgents.
As I've observed this, at least anecdotally, mm-hmm. we've seen that where the candidate got red-to-blue status, there were also sharp elbows given to progressives in these races. And while I'm blocking on her name, but she is a Vietnamese medical doctor who ran in 49 here in California.
Yeah, Mai Tan, I think, is her name.
Yes. And, you know, she was a Bernie-type candidate and was, making that very clear. And they told her to sit down and get out of the race because they had Doug Applegate, the 32-year Marine veteran, and the Jacobs girl, Sarah Jacobs, who is the heiress to a fortune from, I think, Qualcomm.
Yeah.
And she worked at the State Department. So
they sort of knocked each other out.
Mm-hmm.
They conked each other out, and Levin won.
Yeah.
But I think Levin actually won the convention support. But you have... I wrote in May about Texas. There were three runoffs in Texas on May 22nd between military candidates. One was military intelligence, one was a helicopter pilot, and one was a retired West Point guy. They all were running off for Democratic nominations against, one was a progressive activist teacher. Another was a teacher. These are two teachers supported by Our Revolution, and then a woman doctor who was more left wing. And they all greatly outraised them in terms of money, and had party support, and then won in the runoff elections.
Mm-hmm.
So The record for the Sanders candidates or Sanders type candidates, Sanders linked candidates, in districts where the Democratic Party thinks it has a good chance of winning and defeating a Republican, they have generally intervened to block such candidates from winning. In districts where the Democratic Party leadership thinks they have no chance anyway, they have not done so.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they've allowed Sanders candidate, or they've not opposed Sanders candidates winning. For instance, I'll give you an example. The first district in Arkansas, the Democratic nominee is a young man named Chintan Desai, who is a school teacher, son of Indian immigrants who went there under Teach for America and stayed. So he got the Democratic nomination to run against an entrenched Republican incumbent in a district which hasn't elected a Democrat in 25 years. The Democratic Party could care less
mm-hmm.
about such a candidate. But in the second district of Arkansas, which is considered to be competitive because it includes Little Rock, it's based on the state capital and has more of an urban population, the Democratic Party establishment intervened, pumped $500,000 into the campaign of a local state legislator who is reliable and conservative, and brushed aside the candidacy of a more liberal character.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't want they figured they have a chance to win it. They don't want to put up a progressive candidate in that district.
And Patrick, since you watch all these so carefully, I'll just ask you a wild card question. Has any candidate who uses the tag socialist won a nomination in a primary for Congress this year?
In the Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm.
No. But that's not... That's not a reflection on what people think about the label. Our party, of course, on principle, we don't run in the Democratic primary. We're opposed to the Democratic Party. We believe that the working class has to build an independent political party outside the two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
That's our project. There are groups which use the label socialist, but which participate in the Democratic Party, such as the Democratic Socialists of America. These groups have, by and large, accommodated themselves to the leadership of the Democratic Party by restricting their campaigns to state legislative seats. So there were a number of DSA candidates who won Democratic nominations for the state legislature in Pennsylvania, for instance. There were four. Two of them were open members of the DSA, and two were endorsed by the DSA but were not members. And they defeated either Democratic incumbents or Democrats who had more traditional party support. But there are no DSA candidates that I know of running for the House of Representatives in any seat in the country but one. I have found one, and that's in New York City.
Hmm. Okay.
There's a candidate running against Joseph Crowley,
mm-hmm.
who is the number four Democrat in the leadership. But she's running as she's Puerto Rican, and the district is predominantly minority. And so she's raising more. She's not openly calling herself a socialist, even though she has the endorsement of the DSA, and she is, I think, a member of the DSA.
I see.
But she's not. She's emphasizing more the question of identity politics. And legitimately she's legitimately raising the question of immigration, and her number one demand is the abolition of ICE, which is a demand I would support. But you know what I'm talking about.
I certainly do.
Your readers don't have to. I'm not speaking about what you put in your drink.
No, we all know what ICE is.
Yeah, she's raising the demand for the shutdown of the whole immigration prison system, which is a legitimate demand that I would support. I don't think you can accomplish that through the Democratic Party.
No, it's certainly a worthy
that's
goal.
That's certainly a legitimate issue to raise and long overdue.
Yes. Now, Patrick, you mentioned that you do have a list there of these 20 aligned with either the intelligence or military communities. Mm-hmm. Why don't you run through that briefly and just identify the nominee, the district, and the state so that our listeners can get a heads up about who might be running in their area.
All right. Well, okay. In Maine, the furthest east, Jared Golden is running in the second. He appears to be likely to win the nomination. That this is a Maine now has adopted second choice preference voting.
Ranked choice, sorry.
Mm-hmm. And he got, you need 50% to escape ranked choice. In other words, if you get 50% of the first ballot votes, you win automatically.
Right.
He got 49.5%. But the next candidate only got 40%, so he's almost certain to win the, once they do the rollover. He will he is likely to be the nominee. He's a Iraq and Afghanistan veteran who went into the state legislature 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. That's Maine. So then we have New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill, Andy Kim, Josh Welly, and Tom Malinowski are all Democratic nominees for different congressional seats in New Jersey. Mikey Sherrill was a helicopter pilot. Andy Kim was on the National Security Council as Iraq director. Josh Welly was a combat veteran from Iraq. Tom Malinowski was in this, was a State Department official under John Kerry.
Right.
In Pennsylvania, there are three. Chrissy Houlihan was an Air Force captain. George Scott was an intelligence, military intelligence agent. And Connor Lamb, of course, was a military prosecutor who won the special election, and now he's the nominee in a different district because of redistricting.
Right. Okay. That's Pennsylvania.
That's Pennsylvania. In Virginia, you have two, Abigail Spanberger, who is a CIA agent, and Elaine Luria, who is the commander of a Navy warship. She's running in Norfolk. There are two candidates in West Virginia. Tally Sargent in the second district was a State Department official under Hillary Clinton. Richard Ojeda in the third district was a Army Ranger and ran a construction battalion for the Army Rangers in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right, West Virginia.
In Ohio, Kenneth Harbaugh was an Air Force pilot, I believe, or a Marine pilot. He was a pilot in any case. In Illinois, Brandon Kelly was a military prosecutor, then became a state government official. In Kentucky, Amy McGrath was a helicopter pilot. I'm sorry, not a helicopter pilot, a fighter pilot.
I remember that. Mm-hmm.
In North Carolina, Dan McCready was a combat commander. In Texas, there are three. Joseph Kopser was a West Point graduate, military commander, and then Pentagon official. Gina Ortiz-Jones was Air Force Intelligence, and Mary Jennings Hagar was a helicopter pilot in Texas and sued the Pentagon for the and won the right of women to participate in combat roles. And then in California, Jessica Morse was, I believe, an AID official in Iraq.
That's right. And I know
won
a little
in the 4th district, which is she'll be the candidate against Republican Tom McClintock.
Right, and she has a very limited chance to win that. I have friends who have run in that district before, and it's pretty solidly red. So
yeah, it's considered, well, it's classified as likely Republican. In other words, there is a chance, but it's probably a small chance. Depends on if there is a huge turnout, and that turnout is directed against the Republicans in November, which is possible.
Yeah. All right, Patrick.
So that comes to that, by my count, is 20, and then there's another seven that I have tallied that are in non-competitive districts so far. And then there'll be more because we've done about two-thirds of the congressional seats nominees have been chosen. It's about 290 out of 435.
Now, Patrick, I referenced that the World Socialist website published as a pamphlet a version of your original analysis, mm-hmm. and it is available for sale at wsws.org, and people can find it there. It's a handy booklet that identifies all these people with a thumbnail profile, and I think it's also going to be a collector's item of this this particular election cycle.
Yeah, well, if the Democratic Party wins control of the House of Representatives, this pamphlet will be invaluable for telling you who is actually pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to pick that up. And when you visit the World Socialist website, for at least a week or so, there's going to be a video that plays with Patrick Martin, who describes some of his work and is going to make a pitch for contributions. And we're no strangers to that here at the listener-funded Peter B. Collins podcast. So I want to encourage you, if you find this work valuable, and I certainly do, and you've got a few extra bucks that you can share, take a look and consider donating to the World Socialist website, and that'll help support the work of Patrick Martin. Patrick, I appreciate your analysis with this update today, and perhaps we'll check back after the final rounds of primaries in September with a scene setter for the November midterm elections.
That would be fine.
All right, sir. Well, thanks again, Patrick Martin, here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Patrick Martin. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.